and Iraqis killed in 6 weeks. That was taken as a great triumph. And first President Bush saying, quote, by God, we've kicked the Vietnam syndrome once and for all. 1999, 78 straight days of bombing led by the United States, Yugoslavia, and Kosovo. Not a single American died. Great triumph. Cluster bombs being used. By the way, it's not a secret. You can go to the Congressional Research Service and find that during the first 3 weeks of the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, the United States used between 1.8 and 2 million cluster munitions bomblets to shred the bodies of everybody in one of the most heinous, terrible weapons in modern warfare. We hardly ever heard about it. And in fact, you may remember to fast forward that when the Russians invaded Ukraine and it was reported that they were using cluster munitions, they were justifiably denounced by U.S. media, and the White House publicly suggested that might well be a war crime. But then the Ukrainian forces were running out of weapons and ammunition, and the U.S. was running out of resupply ammunition, but the U.S. had plenty of cluster munitions on the shelf. And so President Biden, with bipartisan support in Congress, gave the green light, and there went on from there huge shipping of cluster munitions to Ukraine. It wasn't so bad after all. So how Orwellian can you get? 2022, a war crime. 2023, no problem. This is one of countless examples of the tears of grief, the corruption, the corrosion, if you will, the spiritual desecration of U.S. government, of mass media, and of our own lives, to the extent we accept it. In the fall of 2002 in Baghdad, I met a few of the surviving Iraqi children. UNICEF's director in Baghdad took me around to some schools. The ones that had been refurbished were really nice. There was no smell of sewage. But other schools, I was taken to another one, had not yet been refurbished. They were working on it. The UNICEF office there was trying to provide schools for kids that didn't have sewage smell and broken windows. It was really impressive. And so we went back to the director's office. He was a Dutch person who was running the operations in Iraq for UNICEF. And we talked about how important the improvements were. And then I asked, what do you think will happen if the U.S. invades? And there was a silence. And then he said, that would be a whole different matter. And it was. It was branded in Baghdad by the U.S. media with great excitement, shock and awe. Daniel Ellsberg talked with me about the differences between media coverage of 9/11 and later the U.S. military's shock and awe missile attack on Baghdad that started the Iraq invasion in March of 2003. In response to 9/11, he recalled, the New York Times, and I'm going to quote Dan here, did something very dramatic. They ran a picture, a head picture, of each person who had been killed, 9/11. Each person had been killed with some anecdotes from their neighbors, their friends, their family. This person liked to skydive, or this person liked to play in a band, or little anecdotes about what made them human, what people remembered about them in particular. Very gripping, very moving. And then there was a pause, and Dan went on, and he said, after the Iraq War began in 2003, he said he thought, imagine if the Times were to run a page or two of photographs of the people who were burned on the night of shock and awe. It wouldn't be that hard if you were on the ground. We weren't there then, but we were later to find people who are relatives of those people and say, look, each one had friends, had parents, had children, had relatives. Each one had made their mark in some little way in the world until that moment when they were killed. And these were the people we killed. And these were the people who were dying under the bombing, exactly as in our case, where two planes filled with gas burned two buildings. Dan went on to say, but of course, that kind of U.S. media coverage was unthinkable. He put it this way, of course, it's never happened, nothing like it. Tears of grief. In 2009, when I went to Afghanistan, I went somewhere that any U.S. journalist was free to go. You didn't have to be embedded. It was on the outskirts of Kabul. It was a refugee camp, an internal refugee camp. And it was largely populated by people from the Helmand province in the south who had been driven out by the violence. And it was a very crude makeshift camp, just a bunch of ditches and canvas, basically. And I met a girl named Guljuma. At the time, she was 7 years old. And she talked about how one morning, when she was still sleeping, about 5 a.m., at her home in Helmand province, the walls fell in because a bomb had fallen in the neighborhood. The U.S. was bombing the area. And as she spoke, you could see her kind of tilting her body because she only had one arm. And so the side with an arm was sort of in my direction. So she's in her early 20s now with one arm. And I found out that at that refugee camp, because they were internal refugees, the UN wasn't helping. The Afghan government wasn't helping. The U.S. government was not helping. They took up collections for food from local business people in Kabul. As a U.S. citizen, I thought about it. I thought, wow, my government had the money to bomb these people, but not to feed them. The next year, in 2010, President Obama spoke to troops near Kabul at Bagram Air Base. He said, all of you represent the virtues and the values that America so desperately needs right now, sacrifice and selflessness, honor and decency. And he added, quote, you see dignity in every human being. But even though the United States, quote, lost the Afghanistan war, the fact is that military contractors never lose a war. And so Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, General Dynamics, many other corporations, they always make a literal and figurative killing. William Hartung has authored a report, the great researcher. He found weapons makers have spent $2.5 billion on lobbying over the past 2 decades. They employ on an average over 700 lobbyists per year, more than one for every member of Congress. There's a revolving door between the lobbyists and members of Congress. It swings both ways. The current Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin, is a former member of the board of Raytheon Technologies, the country's largest military contractor. He was getting 7 figures income from the military industry. And if you go to Open Secrets online, you'll find that they discovered and documented before entering the Biden cabinet, Austin and Secretary of State Antony Blinken worked together at a place called Pine Island Capital Partners, described as a private equity firm investing in defense companies that touted its access to Washington. My only correction is they weren't defense companies. They were military companies. You might remember that the Pentagon came up with a name for the impending Iraq invasion in 2003. And naturally, they wanted something that sounded rather grand and wonderful. So somebody there got approval to call the invasion Operation Iraqi Liberation. But there was something wrong. You can probably guess if you can't remember. There was something wrong with, just think of the initials, Operation Iraqi Liberation. Since the acronym spelled OIL, somebody realized that wouldn't do, right? So, of course, it was considered a calumny to suggest with the impending invasion that oil had something to do with it because, you know, the United States government, we're virtuous, we're altruistic, we try to help other people. And we were told that's what the invasion was about. But then the years went by and some people retired and some officials began to speak very differently. So 4 years after the invasion, I'll give you a couple quotes. The senator and actually future Secretary of Defense, Chuck Hagel, said, quote, "People say we're not fighting for oil. Of course we are," unquote. General John Abizaid, who knew something about fighting in Iraq, he was the former head of U.S. Central Command and military operations in Iraq, he said, quote, "Of course it's about oil. We can't really deny that," unquote. One of the great myths, and Biden made a statement at the UN in September 2021 that we've turned a page. He said the U.S. is no longer at war, which, of course, would be confusing to people in countries the U.S. was continuing to bomb, including in the last week here in the middle of November 2023 in Syria. We were told the U.S. wasn't at war anymore because troops had come out of Afghanistan, which was really surprising to people who looked at reports from the Cost of War Project at Brown University. The same month that Biden made that statement, the project documented U.S. military was engaged in so-called counterinsurgency and war on terror operations in 85 different countries. That's quite a gap between no countries in 85. Bombing, missile strikes, drone attacks, joint maneuvers with foreign militaries, on-the-ground advisors and trainers, secretive special ops. And then there's the militarization of our economy or culture, a society teaching men to use guns to kill. Domestic violence, which is clearly documented, way up among veterans, especially those engaged in the war on terror. Terrifying for many women, domestic violence through the roof. PTSD. And then when George Floyd was murdered and there were Black Lives Matter demonstrations around the country, many demonstrators in many cities and towns found that they were facing off against Pentagon equipment because there's something called the 1033 program. MRAPs and other major weaponry systems and armaments are given by the Pentagon to local police forces around the country. And if they don't use them, they have to give them back. We've been hearing a lot, not enough, but since the death of George Floyd, we've been hearing more about systemic racism. And there's an assumption that it's only a domestic problem. One of the things that was startling to me, I was working on the War Made Invisible book for months, and then I started a chapter called Color of War, and then I realized ever since the so-called War on Terror began in October 2001 with the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, almost every victim of Pentagon firepower has been a person of color. It's hidden in plain sight. How many op-eds and commentaries have you seen in mass media even mentioning that? Too embarrassing? Too obvious? It wouldn't have surprised W.E.B. Du Bois. Wouldn't have surprised him at all. The color line doesn't just run through this country, it's global. To be clear, the United States military doesn't bomb countries because they're inhabited by people of color. But if they're inhabited by people of color, that makes it easier for domestic politics and attitudes to engage in warfare on that country. Otherwise, our entire analysis of systemic racism would make no sense. Institutional and individual, we have these biases, and religious and cultural biases too. And as the slaughter continues in Gaza, all of those factors are in play. The two tiers of grief. Of all the wars that the United States has been part of, in so many ways, with so many layers, there is invisibility. Even if it's on our TVs, even if it's in the newspapers and on our screens, the realities of the war are invisible. Yeah, we can see the images, and we're virtually clueless. Remember the old cliche, television brings war into your living room? Sounded good, didn't it? Completely preposterous. Can you think of anything less like being in a war than scrolling on your smartphone or watching a television? But it's something that doesn't stand any scrutiny, but it's very popular because we need that conceit that we are witnessing, we're visible. But what Robert J. Lifton calls psychic numbing, The numbing is crucial to make these policies acceptable to the public. And most of all, in terms of war that would be invisible, is nuclear war. There would be virtually no one left to see the coverage. 8 months after the Cuban Missile Crisis, President John Kennedy spoke at American University. And he drew lessons from that crisis that are now in the dumpster at the White House. This is what Kennedy said. Above all, while defending our own vital interests, nuclear powers must avert those confrontations which bring an adversary to a choice of either a humiliating retreat or nuclear war. To adopt that kind of course in the nuclear age would be evidence not only of the bankruptcy of our policy or of a collective death wish for the world. At the time of that speech by JFK in 1963, Daniel Ellsberg was working for the Kennedy administration. As he told an interviewer a few years ago, Dan said, "What I discovered to my horror, I have to say, is that the Joint Chiefs of Staff contemplated causing with our own first strike 600 million deaths, including 100 million in our own allies." Now, that was an underestimate even then because they weren't including fire, which they found was too incalculable in its effects. And of course, fire is the greatest casualty-producing effect of thermonuclear weapons, so the real effect would have been over a billion, not 600 million, about a third of the Earth's population then. That was 60 years ago. Speaking after his book, The Doomsday Machine, was published in 2017, Dan brought us up to date. He described research findings about nuclear winter. And this is what he said. It's a long quote. It's definitely worthwhile. What turned out to be the case 20 years later in 1983, confirmed in the last 10 years very thoroughly by climate scientists and environmental scientists, is that the high ceiling of a billion or so was wrong. Firing weapons over the cities, even if you call them military targets, would cause firestorms in those cities, like the one in Tokyo in March of 1945, which would loft into the stratosphere many millions of tons of soot and black smoke from the burning cities. It wouldn't be rained out in the stratosphere. It would go around the globe very quickly and reduce sunlight by as much as 70%, causing temperatures like that of the Little Ice Age, killing harvests worldwide and starving to death nearly everyone on Earth. It probably wouldn't cause extinction. We're so adaptable. Maybe 1% of our current population of 7.4 billion could survive, but 98 or 99% would not. So we have a double-barreled climate emergency. The organizing on campuses and elsewhere on climate has been so crucial, so important. We have this existential crisis that is misnamed a climate crisis. It's a climate emergency. And then we have the specter of nuclear war, which, if it occurs, would be speeded up climate crisis, climate emergency, to an unfathomable degree. So as I wrap up here, I want to remind you that while Daniel Ellsberg was extremely well-informed about war and U.S. war-making, he had seen it unfold during the Vietnam War, his deepest passion has been to prevent nuclear war and to wake us up. He says that the single step that could be initiated to reduce the chances of nuclear war would be, yes, unilateral shutdown of all U.S. ICBMs, the intercontinental ballistic missiles. They're on hair trigger alert because, unlike the air and the sea nuclear weapons, they're vulnerable to a first strike. So they are, by definition, kept on launch on warning, hair trigger status. William Perry, former Secretary of Defense, has said ICBMs are the most dangerous weapons in the nuclear arsenal, and yet we can't get anywhere so far in Congress to get them shut down. And part of the charge is, oh no, that would be unilateral disarmament. And I think of it as, let's say you're standing in a pool of gasoline, And your adversary is also standing in the pool of gasoline. And you're lighting matches, and your adversary is lighting matches. If you stop lighting matches, people might say, oh, that's unilateral disarmament. It would also be a step of sanity. In the Doomsday Machine, Dan summed up this way. He described the overall policies of preparing for all-out thermonuclear war. No policies in human history have more deserved to be recognized as immoral or insane. The story of how this calamitous predicament came about and how and why it has persisted for over half a century is a chronicle of human madness. Whether Americans, Russians, or other humans can rise to the challenge of reversing these policies and eliminating the danger of near extinction caused by their own inventions and proclivities remains to be seen. I choose to join with others in acting as if that is still possible. We all know about Dr. King's speech, "I Have a Dream." But when he went down by the riverside to a church in New York City in 1967 and denounced what he called the madness of militarism, that's a no-go for corporate media, the politicians, the Democrats and Republicans who embrace his memory have that part of his legacy down the Orwellian vacuum tube. Dr. King said, quote, "I must honestly say to you that I never intend to adjust myself to the madness of militarism." It's easy to feel overwhelmed. It's easy to feel powerless. But the only possibility of change is if we organize. And if we have a realistic view, not of the fantasy world provided to us by members of Congress overwhelmingly and by presidents and by media, but our own willingness to see. As James Baldwin said, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced." The poet Stanley Kunitz wrote, "In a murderous time, the heart breaks and breaks and lives by breaking. It is necessary to go through dark and deeper dark and not to turn." And from Theodore Retke, "In a dark time, the eye begins to see." Daniel Ellsberg was accustomed to people telling him how much he inspired them. But I sensed in his eyes and in his heart a persistent question. Inspired to do what?
You were just listening to Norman Solomon on the madness of militarism. He gave the second annual Daniel Ellsberg lecture at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst in mid-November. Norman Solomon is a leading independent political commentator and media critic. Author of many books, his latest is War Made Invisible. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 38th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Noam Chomsky, Arundhati Roy, Ralph Nader, and Medea Benjamin. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Norman Solomon on the Madness of Militarism, and for his book, War Made Invisible, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us at 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to the Ellsberg Initiative for Peace and Democracy and to the Media Education Foundation. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Graham Nash, Military Madness.
In upstairs room in Blackpool, by the side of another sea.
Witness Cynthia Megaras, who'd had a squelch, gave it all away. What does it mean to bear witness? The act of witnessing is also the act of universal acceptance. Giving is intertwined with wealth and abundance, depending on the reciprocal relationship one has with land and community. It is this ideology that has helped indigenous nations maintain sustenance for centuries. Following Thema Egaras, performance at SFE Gallery in fall 2022, who had a squelch, gave it all away. Guest participants were invited to recount the event in, as Egaras describes, a collective remembering, a truth about an experience. Listen as participants Tanya Lucan Linklater, Alisa Johnny Hawkins, and Mikel DeAngeli share their witness encounters together in a conversation airing December 12th and 19th on Speak Up from 10 to 11 a.m.